When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Hello and welcome to The Tonight Show. The Taoiseach prepares to meet President Joe Biden in Washington as war rages in Gaza.
Anytime you speak to any audience or anytime you go anywhere in the world, you know, you have to get the tone right.
It's a high-profile opportunity to make the case to the leader of the free world, but given America's lukewarm interest, how forcefully can he make it?
Also coming up on the programme tonight, we debate if there's an emerging price crisis in the electric cars market. And Russia's President Putin hints again at the spectre of nuclear war as he prepares for yet another term in the Kremlin. Joined first tonight live from Washington by our political correspondent Gavin Riley, where Taoiseach Leo Varadkar is preparing to meet with the US President Joe Biden against the backdrop of the war in Gaza. And Gavin, what tone is the Taoiseach likely to take in this meeting?
It was very interesting to hear Leo Varadkar talking about this over the last 36 hours or so. There have really been two hallmark speeches by the Taoiseach, or two interventions, if you like. The first one was at the Ireland Fund's dinner last night. That is a charity event, a black tie gala, which raises hundreds of millions for causes across the island, coming largely from American corporate coffers. Last night at that meeting, which included a great deal number of members of the US Congress and of the US Senate as well, Leo Varadkar raised concerns about Ukraine and got a very warm, sustained applause. Then he raised concerns around Europe and America's role in perpetuating crisis in Gaza, and the response was far more lukewarm, a smattering of applause, but nowhere near the same level of urgency. So then we asked him today, was that lukewarm response going to perhaps change the approach? And he said, well, it's not really about changing the message so much as tailoring the tone. Here's a little bit of how Leo Varadkar said he plans to approach this matter when he sits down with Joe Biden tomorrow.
Just to be very clear, there's nothing I wouldn't say here that I wouldn't say back home, or vice versa. Just to be very clear on that. But I think any time you speak to any audience or any time you go anywhere in the world, you know, you have to get the tone right and you have to tailor the message for the audience that's hearing it. And like that would have been true when I was in Bucharest last week at the EP Congress. You know, you're speaking to German people, you're speaking to a Greek person. It's a bit different than if you're speaking to somebody back home, and you have to be able to get the tone right as best you can and tailor the message in a way that people will hear and understand. That's the objective, to try and influence people.
So we're getting a hint there, Gavin, of the approach by the Taoiseach tomorrow. This year is different because the Shamrock Ceremony and that meeting between the US President and Leo Varadkar are taking place separately. Tell us about the itinerary in the days ahead.
Well, tomorrow is really the busy day of hard politics, if you like. There is that meeting in the Oval Office with the President of the United States that usually runs for about 45 minutes or so. Before that, he is the guest of honour at a ceremonial breakfast thrown by the Vice President, Kamala Harris. That is an element of the schedule, by the way, which was created when Joe Biden himself was Vice President. He was so proud of his own Irish links, he wanted an opportunity to sit down with the Taoiseach of the day as well. After the bilateral in the Oval Office, then it's up to Capitol Hill. Another illustration, by the way, of the significance of the St. Patrick's Day affairs and the access that Ireland has is that visiting Capitol Hill for the St. Patrick's Day lunch thrown by the Speaker is one of only two occasions every year when the President visits Capitol Hill. The other is the State of the Union. Americans are very assiduous about the splitting of the branches of government between the executive branch behind me and the legislative branch up on Capitol Hill. But the President visits twice. One is for the State of the Union and the other is for St. Patrick's Day. That in itself is a high-powered affair. Again, public remarks at that. Afterwards, the Taoiseach gets to sit down with the Speaker, Mr. Mike Johnson, and after that he's also going to be meeting with members of the Congressional Friends of Ireland caucus. So there is a lot of heavy lifting in that tomorrow alone. But then also we mentioned Sunday, the separate Shamrock reception. A lot of people maybe have them conflated in their own minds. That is a separate reception, ordinarily quite jovial. It is effectively a ball thrown by the President. But it is an opportunity for Leo Varadkar to make public televised remarks in front of a public audience live on television with the President at his shoulder. Maybe that might be another opportunity for him to raise some things that America would rather not hear.
Okay, Gavin Riley in Washington, thank you for joining us tonight and bringing us up to date. Well, I'm joined now by Fine Gael Senator Barry Ward, Sinn Féin TD Mac Carthy, and by Mark Price from the Irish Anti-War Movement. You're very welcome along to the programme tonight. Barry, to come to you first, I guess the question is, will the message from Ireland be sent forcefully? We heard the Taoiseach there saying he tailors his tone according to where and who he's speaking to. Does that run the risk of weakening the message?
I don't think so. And in fairness to Leo Varadkar, he has been a thought leader on the Israel-Gaza conflict from the very get-go. He's one of the first Western leaders to call out Israel for the way they're behaving. And he has given a very clear tone already in the United States as to what Ireland feels. I presume that will continue. We won't be present for a private meeting, but I have every faith that he will forcefully put that message.
Yeah, I'm asking you that because he did say of Joe Biden, I believe his heart is in the right place in relation to Gaza. Now, how does that sit when the US is supplying bombs and arms being used by Israel to kill more than 30,000 civilians, most of them women and children? Is this the kind of tone we want to strike, that Joe Biden's heart is in the right place?
No, I mean, I think he is, but it is a very complex position. What America is doing, I think, is unconscionable. What Israel is doing is unconscionable. They are supported in no uncertain terms by the United States, and they're facilitated by the United States.
That, do you believe Joe Biden's heart's in the right place?
I think it is, insofar as he would like to stop this, but the complex political nature of this in the United States...
But sure, you can't stop it. But,
well, he can stop it. Yeah, I agree with you. And I would like to see him stop it. And I think he'd like to. But you and I both know, Claire, that it is never as simple as that. And there are all kinds of competing political interests within the United States. And, of course, they have a system where even though he is the head of the executive branch, he doesn't yield all the power in terms of those deals.
All right. I mean, Mark, when you hear that argument that, you know, Joe Biden can do so much, but he can't do everything, perhaps, to stop what's happening right now, what do you say to that? And what do you say to... the Taoiseach being in the White House and being there and having that meeting and all those various photo calls take place over the weekend?
Well, it's definitely not a normal time. This is an extraordinary... This is the crime of our time. Happening, a mass murder happening live, being live-streamed. Joe Biden can absolutely stop it. And while a protest, and it's not ruled out that Leo Varadkar isn't going to make some kind of a protest, he's not going to say something, a protest in itself isn't going to affect the policy. It will contribute to a worldwide movement, I mean, probably led by the South African case in the World Court. But Biden is very conscious of his democratic constituents, 50% of whom think this is a genocide. So a statement by the Irish Taoiseach at this point would be amazing, would be such an encouragement and such a boon to this movement, because it is the Americans who can stop this.
OK, so you believe actually that there is something to be said for the influence of the Irish in Washington over the weekend, and specifically of Leo Varadkar in his position now with meeting Joe Biden tomorrow, that good can come out of that?
Absolutely. And because this is the one day of the year that Ireland gets handed the microphone, we become, you know, for a moment, we're in the limelight. And this would definitely be a story.
It's interesting on this because there's also this appeal, McCarthy, for Joe Biden. And we've heard this, I think Amnesty are going to have a transatlantic vigil taking place in Dublin and also in Belfast and also in Washington, calling on Joe Biden to listen to his Irish roots. Is that going to strike a chord, do you think, with the President, given how he was on his last visit over in Ireland, that this will have an impact? Because to date, any protests or, you know, even how it impacted perhaps on voting in primaries, that has not changed the US position.
I think, well, frankly, I think the US position has changed somewhat, nowhere near far enough and nowhere near fast enough. There are some things that at this stage are indisputable. There is a genocide happening in Gaza. Children, primarily women, innocent people are predominantly paying the price with their lives. Many of them are starving now. That genocide would not be possible were it not for US assistance and support, financial and otherwise, to the Israeli regime. So the question has to be asked of everybody who cares deeply about these matters. And a lot of them are in Ireland. The Irish people, I think, have a particular affinity with the Palestinian people. What meaningful actions can we take to try and change the course? And to me, that means we have to take every single opportunity. So I welcome the demonstrations that are taking place. I welcome all the direct actions that are taking place. But I also think it is imperative that everybody who has the ear of anybody of influence within the US administration uses that influence and access to the effect that says categorically that US foreign policy in respect of Palestine is wrong and it needs to change. And on its own,
Do you have an expectation that the Taoiseach will make the case strongly for a ceasefire?
Certainly, I have that expectation, and I'm hopeful that he will be very forceful in saying to the US administration, acknowledging the positive role they played in bringing peace to this island, they should be playing an equally positive role, which they haven't been up until this point.
OK, well, the Taoiseach has also promised to raise the case of an Irish-Palestinian citizen trapped in Gaza with Joe Biden. Zach Hania has been unable to leave the war-torn region since the conflict erupted in October. And earlier, I spoke to his wife, Batul Hania, about her husband's case.
Yeah, thank you for having me here, Claire. The situation now for Zach is very critical. As I always say, that it's we have evacuated 6 times from North Gaza because we live in North Gaza. And we evacuated in a very dangerous situation under, you know, bombing and under horror. And to know that the fact that we left Zach behind in this dangerous situation, it just giving me worriness all the time, making me anxious about him. Especially, you know, the situation now is not like before. When we got out earlier in November, it was dangerous already, but it wasn't very hard situation now. It's just shortage of food and aid and proper drinking water. And even he's run out of his medication. He has hypertension himself, and he's run out of this medication and tablets. And I don't know how he copes with this. And but, you know, it just gives me worriness all the time about him.
Mm-hmm. And there was a lot of pressure to see the safe release of Irish citizens in Gaza. And many left, including yourselves. You got to leave and your sons got to leave. Was Zach given a reason as to why he's not been allowed to leave Gaza?
Actually, this is our main problem, is that they don't give us reasons. You know, since I got here, many times I contacted the DFA, and I just wanted to know vivid reasons why he's not let out. He's obviously a civilian, and he doesn't have any, you know, anything to do with any military or anything, but to be civilian, pure civilian. But
his background is that of a translator. He studied journalism in DCU before he moved back to Gaza.
He did, yeah. He has his master's degree in DCU here. And he actually didn't manage to get a work in doing journalism back home in Gaza, but that's why he was doing translation thing. In a translation association, it's media. Mm-hmm. But yes, we weren't told any reasons for not letting him out with us. And it puts us actually in a very confusing situation for me. I want to know why he's not out, mm-hmm. why his name has been not approved, or we were told that he was put on the blacklist or red list. I don't know what this means, but why? This is what.
How has the Irish government helped you, the Department of Foreign Affairs? How have they been assisting you in Zach's case?
You know, to be honest, once we made it here, we came back, me and my kids, we were welcomed in an interview with Tunishta, Mr. Mihail Martin, and he was very kind, actually, but the interview wasn't promising for me. It just, you know, speaking to a political figure, I would expect, like, more action to be done from his side. And he just said to me, I cannot guarantee or promise, what can I do, but that he will, that Zach will come out, but I will do my best. And
the Taoiseach has now promised to raise Zach's case with the US President Joe Biden, he says, if he has time at his meeting tomorrow. Do you take hope from that?
I don't want to lose hope, you know. To be honest with you, I just want to keep hope. So I would say yes and I would say no. I would say yes because I want Zach to be out and I want to take every single action that that would help him out. And yes, from this floor, like, I would appeal to the Taoiseach, yes, please, just do your best. It's just, you know, it's about reuniting family here. And my kids, all the time, you know, they give me hard times. They give me hard moments. Especially, you know, nowadays we are doing Ramadan, you know, our fasting month. It's something like, you know, Christmas, if you want to compare it, it's like a Christmas time, family gathers, people communicate with each other, family reunite. It's time, it's a family time, basically. So we are put in a very hard situation. So please, yes, Mr. Varadkar, do your best and take this action towards, for sake of Zach, to come back here in Ireland.
Batul, thank you for joining us on the programme tonight and telling us about your situation and Zach's situation in Rafah.
Thank you. Thank you, Claire. Thank you.
And that was Batul Hania speaking to me a little before we came on air. Now, I want to just say what the Department of Foreign Affairs has said about this Zach's case, that they're aware of the case and are providing consular assistance. And as with all consular cases, the department doesn't comment on the details of specific cases, but that a small number of Irish citizens do remain in Gaza and that the government, through embassies in the region, have sought clearance for all Irish citizens who wish to do so, and they continue to advocate. I mean, the question here, Barry, is, we have had many Irish citizens who have been able to leave. Zach's family don't know why he hasn't been able to leave. He's now in Rafah and they're really worried about him. He's worried too. Is there any reassurance that the Irish government can give to Batul and the family tonight?
Well, the first thing is that over 70 Irish citizens have been evacuated by the Department of Foreign Affairs and the government from Gaza. It's very difficult to say with any certainty how that will progress from here. It's an impossible position for Batul. I really feel for her. I've been to Rafah. It's not a small place and it's now massively overpopulated with people who have nowhere to stay. They stay. They don't have access to medicine, food and all the rest. So it's an intolerable position. I know the department is continuing to work on that. I know the Minister of Foreign Affairs spoke to the Israeli ambassador, which also shows us the importance of not expelling a person like that, because that channel remains open.
All right.
And it's a
but
further
how,
facility.
How did that proceed?
I mean, I wasn't at the meeting, but what I'm saying is the department is and the government is continuing to keep that pressure on. As you say, there's a small number of Irish citizens left and Irish citizens' dependents left in Gaza. We need to make every effort to get them out. And I know that that pressure is continuing there to make sure that they can be released into Egypt and brought here to Ireland and out of the danger zone. And I've every hope that that will happen for Zach. But as the The government has said they can't make that assurance because they don't control it. It's the Israeli government that controls the borders of Gaza. Even the Egyptians, who would have to allow him into Egypt, they cannot control the access to the Rafah crossing, which goes into Egypt.
And Matt, they also cannot give reasons as to why Zaha Hania remains in Rafah when, as Barry was saying, 70 Irish citizens have been allowed leave and the rest of Zaha's family have been allowed leave and they've been at home missing him since November.
It's vindictiveness on the part of the Israeli regime. There's no other possible explanation for it. And we've seen this, obviously, in Zach's case. There are, as Barry said, a number of small number of other Irish citizens, but there are also elderly parents, other very close family members who were in a vulnerable state before the war began. They have now been shifted from their homes as a result of the bombing of their homes to another part of Gaza where, you know, disease is rife, where, you know, they're literally children starving, this is a regime that, you know, we just can't depend on diplomacy alone. There has to be actions taken against a state that would allow human beings to endure this type of hardship.
And exactly, this is why to go to Washington to treat this as business as usual, go through the motions of handing over shamrocks would be an absolute disgrace at this juncture.
In fairness, Mark, nobody's treating it as business as usual. We're looking for a rational explanation for something that is not rational. And the way the Israelis are behaving is irrational, but it's not business as usual. And as I said, the Taoiseach has on a number of occasions called out Israel. He has led coalitions within Europe of Spain and Belgium and Malta to act against this and speak out against
it. I'd like to let Mark finish his point.
Yeah. But if he goes on Sunday and hands over the shamrocks, that is what I mean by business as usual. That would be unacceptable to all of the people in this island and to a vast number of people in the United States as well, because it would be normalizing something which is outrageous.
Mother's Day is around the corner. Find the perfect gift for the mom in your life with a stunning piece of jewelry from Blue Nile. From timeless pearls to dazzling gemstones, Blue Nile has something she'll adore. Need it fast? Most items can ship overnight. Plus, enjoy guaranteed free shipping and returns. Don't miss our special Mother's Day deals. Save big on the season's most beautiful trends. For a limited time, get up to 50% off by going to BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
Burrow is a furniture company known for timeless design and thoughtful construction, and free shipping, and that extends to their outdoor collection. Their outdoor furniture is built to withstand the elements, featuring rust-proof stainless steel hardware, weather-ready teak, and quick-dry foam cushions. For Memorial Day, get 15% off your Burrow purchase at burrow.com/acast, and up to 25% off outdoor. That's up to 25% off outdoor furniture at burrow.com/acast.
As you've both said, and yes, as with regard to the unfortunate person you were talking about, the American president could have a huge influence on that outcome, as you know, directly.
OK, if the Taoiseach brings up Zach's case, I mean, is that a counter-argument to saying, you know, we shouldn't be there? Is that saying, look, there's influence and there's opportunity with this meeting?
There are a number of ways, Claire, of making a protest. There are a number of ways of using the platform. And now that he's there, what I'm saying is not to just go through, even if he's going to hand over the shamrocks, at least that he says something that's strong and meaningful and not just backroom diplomacy. That's not enough.
All right. Now, Taoiseach Leo Varadkar has said, and he said it in Washington, in fact, that he supports an approach put forward by the European People's Party, the EPP group, around deporting asylum seekers to safe third countries. Critics of the proposal have compared it to the UK's so-called Rwanda plan. Here's what the Taoiseach had to say on immigration policy in Washington.
Well, look, I suppose it's not really a case of the government seeking to dissuade people from seeking international protection in Ireland. What we say to people is there are lots of ways to come to the country legally. If you're from outside the European Union, we have a system of work permits, we have a system of work visas. If you want to come to work in Ireland, there is a system by which you can come to Ireland. So we dissuade people coming to Ireland irregularly if they're not genuinely entitled to international protection. If they are genuinely entitled to international protection, well, then we don't dissuade them.
So under this proposal, just to clarify on what it actually means, a third safe country, it would be that the application wouldn't be reviewed by an EU member state. Instead, it would be outsourced another country.
It would still be reviewed by a European state, but outside the borders of Europe. And this is a policy...
So it wouldn't have, the asylum seeker in question, their case would not be heard in the country that they've fled to. They would instead be moved to another country, a third country that's not in the EU. Outsourcing the issue?
Well, yes and no. It's a third. First of all, it's a safe country, so it is absolutely different to what the UK is proposing to do.
How is it not like the Rwanda plan?
Because what it is about is, it is primarily a policy that is designed with places like Italy and Greece in mind, who are taking over a huge number of migration into their countries, most of it through incredibly dangerous channels that is feeding the coffers of criminals and people traffickers.
Don't they already have agreements, though, in place?
What they have asked to do, our colleagues within the EPP have asked that there would be a policy that would allow them to deal with people before they ever get to the shores of Greece or Italy. So if you're a Syrian person coming through Turkey, that you would be able to be treated there and your application assessed there before you get there, and to prevent you taking that really dangerous journey across the sea.
Does it not look like the European People's Party, which Fine Gael are a member of, you know, flagging this policy, but also sort of saying we can wash our hands of the migrant
issue? It doesn't look like that at all, Claire. It doesn't look like that at all. It is a policy that is designed actually to safeguard people coming to Europe and to ensure that they don't have to make that dangerous journey where over 3,000 of them have drowned in the Mediterranean. It's a policy that is about ensuring their rights.
To go to countries like Libya.
No, sorry. Libya is not a safe third country. But to go to countries that are safe and that are deemed safe by the system. But it is also to allow them to be processed there and prevent the situation where they're putting their lives at risk only to be sent home again at the other end of the process.
Matt, your view on this. I mean, is this... Would Sinn Féin agree in principle to a policy such as this, a third safe country?
I think what all our priorities should be ensuring that we sort out the issues within the domestic asylum system, which is absolutely broken. We have 1,000 people approximately sleeping on the streets of our capital city predominantly. Tonight we have local communities that are in absolute conflict with the way government have handled the accommodation of asylum seekers. And we have a system that is far too slow, inefficient. What we actually need is an asylum process that's fair, that is efficient and enforced when it needs to be.
Now, and the Taoiseach did, you know, flag this endorsement of the policy by saying, you know, the situation here right now as being very difficult and the state not being able to guarantee accommodation to people if they arrive, therefore giving backing to this EPP manifesto.
Well, this wouldn't make any difference to people who are currently here because we have to process their applications. The time frame for doing that is still far too long. We also have a situation where there are people in Ireland that have actually received deportation or orders that haven't actually left because we haven't enforced the system in place. And in some instances, they're in state-run accommodation while others are sleeping on the streets of Dublin.
Barry, very briefly, and I want to go to your namesake, but it's Barry Andrews, who has tweeted around this and said, regarding, you know, Fine Gael's backing of the EPP on that, when you become far right in order to deal with the far right, then you've lost and they've won. What do you say to that?
That's a preposterous political point scoring thing for Barry to say. But what this is about, as I say, is less about immigration or international protection in Ireland, much more about those who are drowning in the Mediterranean and making sure that they... Because at the moment, European law doesn't allow them to be dealt with in Turkey or somewhere like that. And it's about safeguarding them rather than having a situation where they're endangering and putting their lives on their line.
OK, there we'll have to leave that. My thanks to Barry Ward, to Matt Carthy and to Mark Price. Coming up next, prices for consumers in the electric cars market. We discuss it with some experts. Do stay with us. Welcome back. I'm joined by County Wicklow car dealer Nadia Adan, environmental journalist and campaigner John Gibbons, and motoring journalist Shane O'Donoghue from CompleteCar.ie to look at the issue of electric car prices as the market grows in the face of a climate crisis. But also with that growing market, there are concerns about price depreciation and what's happening once you drive that electric car out of the forecourt. Nadia, you've gone out on a limb as a car dealer and maybe saying what other, you know, car dealers are not saying right now. You tell us, but you're no longer taking trade-ins on EVs or buying them in. Why?
Yeah, absolutely, Claire. I suppose, look, I'm coming from the point of view of a used car dealership. I don't sell brand new EVs, so it's all well and good if you buy a new one and you give it back after a year or two. I'm taking them in secondhand, and some of it when it's after manufacturer warranty, and the pricing of it all now is just, it's totally off the wall. And I'm a small business. I sell one or two cars a week, sometimes more, sometimes none. And one of these price fluctuations could put me out of business. So this isn't an attack on EV or an agenda or I'm biased against EV. In fact, I've probably shot myself in the foot here, because since I've come out publicly, prices in petrols and diesels have gone up, you know?
Okay, so what you're saying is, though, that, you know, if somebody was to come to you and say, look, I have my EV, it's 18 months old, and I've decided, you know, I want to go back to a diesel or petrol, or for whatever reason, anyway, they want to trade in, maybe they want to upgrade, you're going to say, no, it's not worth it for me, and I won't be able to give you the price that you're looking for. Is that
pretty much, because even now I've spoken to so many dealers and we can't gauge a real price on it at the moment. Like, I've had customers ringing me, you know, 2 to 3 times a week to actually get out of their newer Teslas and back into an older diesel, because maybe their equity isn't in their finance anymore. And I suppose I'm a small business in Wicklow. My reputation is everything. And if I take in one of these cars and in 6 months' time, Mary and Joe down the road come up to me to trade in, and I can't give them the value, I can't take it in, and I have to look at
them every
day.
So what are you offering? I mean, what sort of depreciation are we looking at right now?
So it depends on the model. So on the very premium models, we have seen, like, the Taycans, and we've seen a lot of it in the UK. They have depreciated in 2 years nearly 40%. And in November of 2023, we saw 500 Taycans for sale on Auto Trader, which is really crazy to see that amount of Taycans for sale. There should only ever be maybe 10 of them at a time. So that was a real flag. Mm-hmm. And as you know, we follow the UK and we're starting to see that here. But even middle of the road, say ID3s, a 2024 ID3 is going for about 40-ish grand, and a 2022 is going for about 20 grand. So again, it's all well and good in the first couple of years if that's your lifestyle. But again, I'm coming from a car dealership that's dealing with the back end of it.
Okay, so what Nadia appears to be saying then is, after 2 years, and we've heard this anecdotally as well, that the price depreciation is pretty massive for these EVs, Shane. Would you accept that?
It is right now, absolutely. If we had this conversation...
What's happening?
Well, there's been a massive shift change in the market. There's been big reductions in new car prices in terms of EVs. And that, of course, shifts downwards. So what we saw, where we saw the start of it, was perhaps Tesla did a big, huge reduction on its cars as new cars. And that filters down. That suddenly means that somebody who's bought a Tesla last year, it isn't worth as much anymore. And that goes throughout the whole marketplace, not just Tesla. All the other big brands have reduced their prices as well.
And why are they pulling their prices back? Is there an acknowledgement that they were overpriced to begin with?
I don't think any of them have come out and said anything
like
that.
No, they're not. But I mean, is that the sense in the industry? Because that's always been the complaint when we're being pushed to go green, to switch to electric, that people say, oh, you know, I'd love to, but I simply can't afford to buy an electric car at the prices they're at.
I'm not convinced, to be honest. There's such a massive investment in any new technology for any product in the world whatsoever, not just cars. Tesla took a strategy. They wanted effectively to saturate the market. And that's not something they're doing just in Ireland or just in Europe. It's something across the world. And they probably led the way. And then the other brands pretty much had to follow suit, or else they just wouldn't sell cars.
OK, what do you say to what Nadia said, though, that, you know, she's not willing to accept, you know, second-hand or trade-ins on electric vehicles?
Well, I fully understand it from a small business point of view, and I suspect it's very much a of-the-moment thing as well.
Is it reflective of the industry?
I don't think bigger dealerships and dealer groups that are representing manufacturers can do that, can just say, no, we're not taking EVs back. Mm-hmm. It just is done. I think in a small business, it's different. You know, as you're saying, a few cars a week, you absolutely have to take consideration.
It's ominous, though, isn't it?
I'm not so sure it's quite so ominous. And I think it's a very... of the moment thing.
Of the moment, Nadia. Would you agree with that?
Look, I hear you and I hear what you're saying. And yes, if things did get better in the future, absolutely, I'd love to sell EVs. I'm not biased on any one brand. I want to make money. But the other side of it is the infrastructure. It's just not there. Let's take Norway for an example. We have a very similar population with Norway, and they have 25,000 charging points. They have a fast charger every 50 kilometres. And they've been planning this for 20 years. Now, I know Mr. Eamon Ryan announced there last week about a 21 million investment, which is great. But if we look over to the UK, Rishi Sunak has announced, I think it was something like 2.3 billion, which is 200 times per capita in Ireland. So I just think that we are really, really far away. It is a worldwide issue, but also I'm seeing it on a local issue as well.
Yeah. John, isn't that true? Like, it's a very popular concern with people, and for environmentalists like you who would love to see everyone drive an EV or use public transport. But look, if you don't have that and you're not walking, you know, get in an electric car. If it doesn't make economic sense, why would anyone buy into it?
I think the whole market is in flux. Think about it this way. For over 100 years, essentially, we had the internal combustion engine. That was it. That was the choice between petrol and diesel for over a century. So we're now in a phase shift of technology. So this is the first major shift in technology in the automobile industry in more than 100 years. That means nobody really knows how it's going to pan out. So, for example, the main reason why electric car prices have tumbled over the last couple of years is that the battery manufacturing prices per kilowatt hour are falling off a cliff. They've come down, I think, about 40% over the last 2 years. Now, that's because more and more companies are manufacturing. They're getting better at it. As Shane alluded to earlier, the more entrants into the marketplace, the more expertise, and then the costs begin to come down.
So for those who are first to get on board and say, I'm going to be sustainable, I'm going to be green, they're paying the price.
Well, there's a hit for anybody, any new adopter in technology, and I include myself in that. I've been an EV-only driver for 6 years. And, yeah, I probably paid too much for my EV originally. But that was the decision, Claire, that I made. I was in a position to do that. I wanted to, as you put it, do the right thing. I made that call. No, I appreciate that. And the market now is maturing. We're now getting to a point in 2024 where you'll have realistic options for under 30,000. And it's important to say as well that once you do bite the bullet and become an EV driver, things get really much better from there. Because, for example, your servicing costs drop to almost nil. Your running costs relative to a diesel or a petrol car are much, much lower. So in many respects, once you get over the hump of purchase, then it's all better.
Would you agree with that, Nadia, about the servicing of EV cars?
It's all well and good, again, in the first couple of years of ownership, because you can just throw it back to the manufacturer. But when you're going into second-hand car market and it's after manufacturer warranty, and even if you look at the fine print of these warranty documents, they won't warranty it after 150,000 kilometres, the lithium batteries. And let me tell you, that's a couple of years of driving with people in Ireland at the moment. So again, I know a very, really good mechanic. He's really well regarded in the motor trade. He has a Renault Zoe there at the moment that has an issue with the battery. It's costing $8,000 to fix it, and it's actually the same value of that Renault Zoe, and the family just had to leave it there and go buy a new car.
If I could just briefly pick up on that, I think it's important to say, first of all, the standard warranty on an EV battery is 8 years. That's probably twice the warranty length that you're getting on your petrol or diesel car. Now, if you have a diesel car and it's 6 or 7 years old and you have a major engine failure, that could cost you a lot of money. Mm-hmm. Now, generally speaking, when we say an EV battery, generally speaking, they don't have a single battery. They've actually got batteries with dozens or hundreds of components. So if you have a battery failure in most cases in an EV, what they do is they replace a module or two or three. So it might cost you a couple of grand. But it's very similar in costs to what you might accept if you encountered a major mechanical failure in a car. But along the way, Claire, you're not having to deal with spark plugs and fans and timing belts and all those moving parts that are part and parcel of an internal combustion car. Those costs go down. And we haven't even got on to talking about the ecological side yet.
The other side of that is, as well, they don't have enough trained mechanics to actually deal with secondhand EVs. I have a BMW i8. I've owned it for 8 years at the moment. It's currently in BMW with an issue with the battery. They've had it for 8 weeks and they can't figure out what's wrong with it.
I'm amazed BMW wouldn't have mechanics capable of fixing their own car.
I'm not saying
car.
They don't have mechanics capable, but they can't figure out exactly what's wrong with it because even though it's around so long, they still don't have that sort of, like, the workshops and the training.
And we're not just
in secondhand,
obviously referring to, you know, BMW alone, but you're saying that this concern, and would you agree with that, Jane, maybe across the industry about even experts catching up with the new technology and problems that maybe people haven't foreseen becoming a problem with electric cars because they are so new on the market?
Well, they're not that new on the market. You know, the Nissan Leaf, for instance, is well over a decade old.
I suppose mass use, you could say.
True. And I think across the board, we have issues recruiting in the motor trade for technicians, etc. So I think in terms of the used car market and, say, local garages, there's probably not so good training as there is at the dealer level. There's probably that issue there and a challenge there. But I do wonder, I think there's a bit too much hysteria about replacing batteries. And just picking up again on what John said there, in most cases, especially in the latest generation, the newer battery technology, you never replace a whole battery. At no stage will you have to fork out €20,000 for a battery because there isn't a piece that you replace. Batteries can be replaced, or battery components can be replaced.
I just briefly want to come back to just the infrastructure that's in place and this term range anxiety that people will be quite familiar with, that you're not sure if you can get to your destination, get to Cork and back, get to Galway and back without having to stop somewhere. We're not Norway. We don't have EV charging points every 50 kilometres. We have a long way to go. That's a big deterrent for people right now. Would you agree for motorists that I suppose the cost of getting on board the EV train, if you like, you still, with that, you don't get the certainty that you may get with your petrol or diesel car right now, that's putting people off?
Yeah, there's certainly a bit of that still around. And I think range anxiety itself is perhaps replaced by charger anxiety, or, you know, anxiety that you're going to be able to get to a charger that is empty, that you won't have to wait around too long, etc. Because most of the EVs these days actually have a really good range for a very good value. Even, you know, John mentioned a minute ago, cars coming in under €30,000 this year, but even those cars are going to have a 300-kilometre range. So you buy a car that suits your needs, and then it's a case of there is a change of mentality, perhaps, and you have to adapt to it, but it really isn't all that difficult to do.
All right, OK, there we will leave that for now. Everyone will have their own view on it, whether they have an EV or they don't. But my thanks to Nadia, to John and to Shane. Coming up next, Russian leader Vladimir Putin warns of nuclear war again. But just how real are these threats? Do stay with us. Welcome back. Russian President Vladimir Putin has urged people to vote for him in elections this weekend as Ukraine launched a series of deadly attacks on border regions. The former KGB agent is set to extend his rule by another 6 years in an election that the Kremlin says will show that Russians are fully behind his war in Ukraine. I'm joined here now by journalist and Russian expert Jason Corcoran. Jason, you're welcome to the programme tonight. Putin looks set for another term. Is there any chance at all of an upset, of a protest vote being logged here?
I think, Claire, there's 0%. This weekend, we're going to see the special election operation. Before, we had the special military operation, which didn't go very well for the Kremlin because they expected to carve up Ukraine within a matter of weeks, and they failed. 2 years later, we're still at the war. So Dmitry Peskov, Putin's spokesman, said last year that there's no democracy in Russia. There is an expensive bureaucracy. And by that, he means they're going to use a carrot and stick this weekend. The stick being all of the public sector workers, including a million from Russian railways, will be encouraged to vote for Putin. And the carrot will be there will be raffles in the polling stations. So there'll be raffles for Lada cars and for sanctioned goods like Dyson curling tongs and iPhone 15s.
All right. But, I mean, what's the political atmosphere like right now in Russia? We've had the death of Alexei Navalny. And we also have, obviously, you know, with all of this, a war that's been going on for 2 years now that is costing Russia an awful lot of soldiers and costing an awful lot of money as well. What's the public feel about all of this?
There's a lot of gloom and doom, Claire, in the streets of Moscow and the big cities. Body bags are coming back, not just to the poor regions. You're seeing mothers and you're seeing wives mobilising against the war, and they're saying, bring our boys home. And you saw that as well being manifested at Alexei Navalny's funeral 2 weeks ago. For the first time in 2 years, people felt they had a voice. They were inspired by Alexei Navalny to actually speak up and called for a Russia bez Putina, Russia without Putin. And they were calling Putin a murderer on the streets of Moscow. So there is a chance that this could be repeated, actually, at the weekend when the elections take place.
OK, that we will see protest.
So Alexei Navalny, on February 1st, 2 weeks before he was killed in the Gulag in the Arctic, he called for a flash mob across Russia, across the 11 time zones. So for people to come out and vote at 12 o'clock at high noon in Moscow, Vladivostok, Kaliningrad in the Baltics, and to vote for anybody but Putin, even for the straw men, or to spoil their votes, and to come out with flowers. So the authorities can't really, you know, block them because they're going to vote to exercise their democratic mandate. And so they should be safe from being thrown in paddy wagons.
And just tell us, like, the logistics of this. Will he go unopposed, or are there other, you know, other names in the ballot?
So in this particular election, there is just the systemic opposition. So you have the Communist Party, you have the Liberal Democrats, who are actually ultra-nationalists, and one other party, which is a fig leaf towards the Liberals. Mm. And these guys will vote for everything in the Duma that Putin asks for. They will vote for another mobilization of the army.
Now, Vladimir Putin has told the West that Russia is technically ready for nuclear war, and that if US sent troops to Ukraine, that would be considered a significant escalation of the conflict. Are these hollow threats, or is there a real fear that we could see an escalation and that nuclear threat, like, would become a real one?
I think we've seen a lot of bluster. If you go through the records, every week somebody from Putin's Politburo makes a threat to turn the West into nuclear ash. We've seen it from Dmitry Medvedev, the former president, who's now deputy head of the Security Council. And we saw it a year ago from Dmitry Kisilov, who's one of Putin's main propagandists. And he actually had an infographic whereby Ireland was wiped off the map in an attack against Britain. So this is a lot of bluster, I think. Unless Putin is put into a corner whereby maybe Crimea could be taken back by the Ukrainians and he might launch a tactical nuclear strike. So not yet.
What's happening, and we mentioned it there, on Russia's borders with these threats by pro-Ukraine militia groups there? Is there any real significance in that activity?
I think it's a real moral boost for the Ukrainians. So they're losing ground in Donetsk and eastern Ukraine. They lost Avdiivka not so long ago. So these guys are Russian partisans who are backed by the Ukrainians, who operate from Ukraine, and they launch sorties into places like Kursk and Belgorod. Belgorod is a city 40 kilometres inside Russian territory, and it's being bombed on a daily basis. And we're also seeing, Claire, as well, which is very important, Ukrainian drones have hit 14 refineries and fuel depots right across Russia and near Moscow. So this is going to put pressure on prices, and there could be fuel shortages in Russia, which will really hit public morale.
And briefly, I mean, an end to all of this. We knew it was going to be a long, protracted war. We're more than 2 years in at this point. What does an off-ramp look like?
At the moment, Russia has the momentum in eastern Ukraine, unfortunately. And this seems to be the only off-ramp. And the pressure is being exerted on Ukraine and President Zelensky, whereby they would agree a deal whereby they would have to cede some of the existing territory that Russia holds. But things can change.
All right. Jason, thank you for joining us on the programme tonight. That is it from us. Our programme is available as a podcast on all major platforms. But from all the late team here, good night. Take care.
Normally, being a little extra can be a bit much, but when it comes to healthcare, it pays to be extra. And United Healthcare makes it easy with Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they supplement your primary plan, helping you manage out-of-pocket costs without the usual requirements and restrictions like deductibles and enrollment periods. So when it comes to covering your medical bills, you can feel good about being a little extra. Visit uh1.com to find the Health Protector Guard plan for you.